Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. And I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Colin Fisk, Director of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities, or as I always call him, CRTP. Hey, Colin.
Hello, Tom.
And we are joined by Dan Zack of Zack Urban Solutions, a planner who is going to talk to us today about urbanism and how we can incorporate principles of urbanism into here, our rural county.
And Tom, I just want to make sure that everybody knows that next Thursday, April 7th at 6 o'clock, CRTP will be sponsoring a talk by Dan on the principles of good infill development. It'll be on Zoom, and folks can register for that. There's a link on our website, which is transportationpriorities.org. And I hope everyone who's interested registers and can hear more from him then.
And you can also find the link on the Lost Coast Outpost, where the show notes for this show will be posted. Hey, Dan.
How you doing? Good to be with you.
So, Dan, maybe you'd like to just introduce yourself and give our listeners some understanding of your expertise and why we're even talking to you.
Sure. So I've been an urban planner for 25 years. I currently live in Fresno, and that's where I grew up and started my career. Another rural part of California that also has several cities, and including some big ones and a lot of really small ones. But even though most of the landscape might be ag land here, most of the folks live in a town or a city. Started my career here, went to Fresno State. And then in 2003, I migrated up to the Bay Area in a town called Redwood City, which is part of the greater Silicon Valley area. Was there for 11 years, and it was the perfect spot to be at the perfect time. If you want to learn how to build a walkable, compact city that is fun and economically viable. And I got my hands in everything from parking to form-based codes to designing a town square and streetscapes and a small enough staff where you didn't get pigeonholed as the fence height variance expert. Like, you got to do a little bit of everything, especially if you were willing to dive in there. And it was the perfect time to do that. And then 2014, the mayor of my hometown recruited me to come back. And she said, hey, bring what you learned. We're ready for you here now. Fresno is going to do really cool stuff downtown. And we want to infill the old neighborhoods and really bring this place back to life. That's a hard call to reject. So she wore me down and I came back and it was great. And so I've been here since 2014. I just left the city of Fresno in January of this year to start my own consulting practice to continue to try to do good things here in Fresno, but in a different way from the other side of the counter. And then also get involved in things in other cities as well. So that's what I'm about. But at the end of the day, I want to build walkable towns, walkable neighborhoods that make people happy, are inclusive, and fun.
Fantastic. I think that almost everyone shares that idea that we should love the place that you live, that it should be walkable, it should be accessible, it should be on a human scale.
100%.
We're talking about urbanism. Urbanism can be scary for someone in Humboldt County because we are repeatedly told that this is a rural area. When we say that we want to incorporate principles of urbanism into our land use planning, no one here wants to be San Francisco. The idea that we're going to import kind of San Francisco values into Humboldt County is always a topic of concern. So maybe we can kind of break it down and go back and understand, what are we talking about when we talk about urbanism? Because this is a term of art used in planning. What is urbanism? What are the broad principles of urbanism?
Urbanism is, if you're not on a homestead in the middle of a farm, a mile or more away from the nearest person, you're in some sort of urban environment. And we always think of like the financial district in San Francisco or lower Manhattan when we think of, oh, urban, that means skyscrapers and this overwhelming crush of human activity. But really, urbanism is on a spectrum. A little hamlet with a couple hundred people, it's urban. That's at one end of the urban spectrum, all the way up to San Francisco Financial District or Lower Manhattan. And frankly, I think they're all really cool. They all serve a really important purpose. And the goal should not be, oh, this end of the spectrum is bad, this end of the spectrum is good. It's all about whatever end, wherever you are on that spectrum, be the best that you can be. The best little 200-person hamlet that you can be. be the best big city metropolitan financial district that you can be. What distinguishes urbanism from other forms of development is that it puts people first. It's the way we built for 5,000 years up until the mid-1950s, when we really went to a different thing. It's all about putting people in close proximity, making public spaces really nice places to be, making walking your primary mode of transportation, followed by bike and transit. These days, you have to make space for the car, but that's not what you design everything around. The cars are a guest. And they can come in, but you're not designing everything around them. You're designing it to be nice, to go out, hang out on your porch, say hi to the neighbors, walk to the coffee shop, kids to play out in the street and that kind of environment. And then, yeah, we'll introduce cars in because they have a role and they can be really convenient for certain kinds of things. And that's really what urbanism is. And it works in your region. It works in my region. It works everywhere. And what's interesting is we think of it as this foreign intervention. And even though Fresno is a big city, we still think of ourselves in a lot of ways as a small town. And some people think of urbanism as this outside intervention being foisted upon us. But look at a picture of Fresno from 1920. And what do you see? You see high rises. Even a town of 40,000 people were building 10, 15 story skyscrapers. We had 50 miles of streetcars. There were wide sidewalks just packed with pedestrians, just a couple of cars here and there. That's urbanism. And that is actually kind of the natural order of things in our region. And I suspect if I looked up a picture of Eureka in 1920, I might see a similar scene, maybe not the 15 stories, maybe more like five or six. But you look at everything. I mean, you look up any random town, 1920, find a historic picture, you can mistake it for Manhattan. Dense walkable cities is how we did it everywhere up until we used some pretty heavy-handed regulations and some pretty market-distorting subsidies to totally change course and create this new untested thing that now is ubiquitous, but it really took a big intervention to kind of shift courses. So to me, urbanism, that's natural.
It is natural. And let's take a look at two local communities. Let's think about downtown Garberville and Southern Humboldt. It's a very rural place. It's Southern Humboldt, right? People went there to escape the pressures of a big city. But if you walk along the street in downtown Garberville, you'll have street trees that shade the sidewalk, and you'll have mixed-use development with commercial on the bottom, and you'll have apartments on top. And it feels appropriate. It feels nice. You want to be in a space like that. Now let's go north. McKinleyville was largely planned after kind of that 1950s planning revolution where we started to put planning for cars above planning for people. It is way more urban in one sense. It has a higher population, but it is so, you obviously as a human on the street are not kind of the intended product there. You have the street right next to the parking lots with the buildings pushed back from the street front. You have divorced uses. You have your commercial district, and then you have your residential areas. And then that forces the use of cars because they're far away and it's inconvenient and often hostile to walk to one place or another.
I think that's a great example of why one of the things we talk about sometimes in Humboldt is how a sort of urbanist development plan or an infill development focus actually is one of the main ways that we can preserve the rural landscapes up here. Because if you look at historic satellite and aerial images of McKinleyville, you see that it wasn't too long ago that it was largely agricultural. Before that, of course, forests and wildlands. And then this focus on car-focused development led to largely the elimination of that rural landscape, whereas Garberville is an interesting counterexample where it hasn't really sprawled out too much and Southern Humboldt is still largely rural.
Yeah, we have the same issues in Fresno with farmland preservation and low density, car-oriented sprawl pattern development really eating into some of the most productive farmland on earth. I was just looking it up the other day. Fresno County is the most productive county in the nation, agricultural wise. Over $7 billion worth of food comes out of this county every year, number one in the nation. The Central Valley as a whole, with 1% in the nation's farmland, produces 25% of the nation's food. So this is important land. And we're covering it with strip malls and McMansions on cul-de-sacs and a very thin smear of people. So yeah, if you really care about wildlife habitat, farmland, forest land, wetlands, the best thing you can do to protect it is to create urban environments that are so good that people will voluntarily cluster themselves on less land, preserving all those wild areas and agricultural areas. I mean, let's not forget Orange County was called Orange County because of all the orange orchards, right? Go find agriculture now in Orange County. It's a novelty. Santa Clara Valley, now known as Silicon Valley, also used to be an agricultural wonderland. And now that industry is completely exterminated. And so if you care about these open areas, then we have to make it really desirable and allowable for people to voluntarily cluster themselves together into denser towns, and then you can save those places. But otherwise, we just spread out endlessly into the landscape, and it only takes a couple of folks at these low densities to really wreck a natural environment and hog up a lot of room.
Let's talk about ways that we can better mix uses. So I talked about how in McKinleyville, your commercial area is divorced from your residential, from your industrial, from your ag lands. Let's talk about ways that we can incorporate these together and still have some cohesiveness. The city of Arcata right now is contemplating a new area plan for the Gateway area, a neighborhood within the city. And they're talking about using form-based codes. This is new to a lot of people. They are confused. They don't know what a form-based code is. And often in confusion, we can breed hostility. So let's break it down. What are we talking about when we're talking about form-based codes, and how can they be useful in creating human-centered neighborhoods?
So at the basic level, when you're talking about a form-based code, you're talking about something that would replace and serve a similar purpose to your city's zoning ordinance. And it might even be a chapter in your city's zoning ordinance. So we say code, but we're not talking about building codes that are more about fire prevention and seismic safety. And that's a separate thing. We're talking about form-based codes. We're talking about better zoning. And we call them form-based codes because traditional zoning that really started in the 1940s, but became pretty ubiquitous by the 1960s, its organizing principle was land use. Is this area housing? Is this area commercial? Is this area industrial? Is this area civic? Whereas a form-based code, the organizing principle is the form of the building. Are these buildings that are more freestanding and detached? Are these buildings that are lined up in a row and right at the back of the sidewalk? It's that form that is organizing principle. You still get into use a little bit and other things, but it's all built around that building form.
So the idea of the separation of uses, if you were like me and you grew up playing Sim City, you will remember making large blocks of light green residential and then some blue next to it and then maybe the brown industrial. That is the traditional way of doing it, where we will segregate our uses into different areas of a city. And form-based codes, it can look like anything. Your form is what people want the neighborhood to look like in the end. It is how you like to live in this area. So in many places, it is that kind of urban form where you have buildings right to the edge of the sidewalk and you have kind of the commercial mixed together with residential. It doesn't have to be that. You can develop the form however you like it to be, and all resulting development then matches the form that you are trying to replicate.
Yeah, exactly. And so I often explain it in a way that in a zoning ordinance, a conventional suburban car-oriented zoning ordinance, you'll have residential zones, and we even break up the residential from really low density single family, more moderate density single family, multifamily is separate, and then different commercial zones, small shopping centers anchored by a CVS, bigger shopping centers anchored by a supermarket or whatever else, regional shopping malls. Each of those have their own zone. And then there are parking requirements and setbacks and height limits all oriented around those finite uses that we break down.
The Eco News Report, and we're talking with Dan Zack of Zack Urban Solutions about urbanism, this idea of how we can incorporate good modern planning into our land use plans.
With a good form-based code, you still have different zones, but they're based around a certain form. So maybe one zone is based around, think about classic pre-war residential neighborhoods in towns in your area with the front porches, maybe a 10 or 15 foot deep lawn. The houses are detached and they've got a pitched roof. That's one of your form zones. And a form-based code might be looser on uses. All the buildings have to take that form, but maybe you're allowed to have a small business in there. as long as it looks like a house, maybe it's a duplex and nobody knows and nobody cares because it has that great form. And so it's a little bit more fluid in that way. And then you might have a zone that's maybe a little closer to the center of town that has more of a brownstone type of form, or the Painted Ladies on Alamo Square. Okay, the buildings are still low scale, but they're closer together. They touch, they're up right up closer to the sidewalk. It's even a little bit more fluid with the uses. And then you might have another zone that's the classic American Main Street, maybe 3-4 stories, buildings that are simple blocks that shoulder to shoulder with active ground floor with a storefront. Maybe on the main drag, it's restaurants and retail shops. Maybe on side streets, it's insurance offices and beauty salons, right? And then for a lot of towns, that might be it. For a town my size that's bigger, 500,000 folks, we might have an additional zone that's a little pocket of your Manhattan or whatever, right in the middle where you have the high rises, because the employment base, the population size, the transportation system all warrant that for a bigger city. And so you've got an area where, hey, we can even do that for them. The uses are completely mixed. But with use-based zoning, it started out with a big victory in the late 1800s when the first zoning codes separated out industrial uses from neighborhoods. I mean, you used to have really nasty smoke belching factories just dropped right in the middle of a neighborhood, and it literally dropped the property values and made people less healthy. So the first zoning prohibited that and put that stuff kind of downwind in its own area. And it was a huge victory. And then they went nuts with it. And oh, we got to separate everything now. And they went too far. But that's kind of how it got started.
Another question that I think a lot of people have about form-based codes is the sort of the process question, because it's interesting to me that we do regulate form in a lot of ways with the more traditional zoning codes, but typically that's subject to a lot more discretionary review by, say, a design review committee or a planning commission or just planning staff about how we think a particular building should look or fit in. And the planning form-based code sort of takes that and makes it more uniform and more clearly applied. But then it also makes it so that maybe there's not as much of a discretionary process for each individual project. And I know a lot of folks are worried about that. So could you address what are the benefits of doing things that way as opposed to the traditional zoning that people are familiar with?
Absolutely. If a town wants to go with the form-based code because they want to end up with a better product, they want to get back to their walkable roots or create a new walkable environment where there never had been one, then they can still have a say on how things look. But the best practice is to do it this way. When you're embarking on putting this code together, you get the town together, you really outreach to people, you figure out what folks like, what makes them tick, what makes the town tick, what feels right, and you kind of reverse engineer your form-based code out of that. And then developers that come in and follow it to a T. Okay, we wanted brick, they're giving us brick. We needed a storefront, they're giving us a storefront. We wanted it to the sidewalk, they're putting it on the sidewalk. We wanted mixed use, they're giving us mixed use. Then staff approval, ministerial, we call it in California. And that means no environmental review. You don't have to go to planning commission, design review. If they're willing to do this pre-vetted design, then reward them with, hey, just a couple of months and you're done with planning and you're off to go get building permits. Everybody doesn't need to have a say on each individual project because they had their say up front and their input was baked into that code. And the developer followed it to a T, so they don't have to revisit it. It's been pre-vetted. And the alternative is that we didn't do it in Fresno, but we did it in Redwood City. And I think it was a good tool. We had the pre-vetted, quick and easy process, like I just explained. And then we had a secondary process where, okay, there's certain things that are non-negotiable. Downtown, the building has to be up to the sidewalk. Parking has to be in the back. These are just fundamental things. But if you have a different approach, you want to play with some different materials, make the building look a little different. Maybe you want to try a more modern look. Well, sure, let's have a look at it. You're not guaranteed to get approved. We might want to dabble in there with you a little bit and move things around. You'll have to go to the design review committee and it's a discretionary approval. But who knows? Maybe everybody will love it in the end. So we'll hear you out, Mr. Developer. And if you're willing to go through a little bit of a longer process with a little less certainty in the outcome, then that's an option. And then the public does get back in. Hey, you're straying from the plan. We already pre-vetted this other thing, but we'll hear you out on this other idea. And that creates a really cool framework for, hey, developers that don't want to fuss around with all that. They follow the plan to the T. They give you a building just like you wanted, and they get rewarded with that quick approval. And that incentivizes them to really follow the plan. It's a huge incentive. But you don't preclude something cool and unique from having its day in court. And then people get to chime in on that. And if someone's unique idea is terrible, well, it doesn't make it through. But if it's really cool, then you don't miss out on that neat idea.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really helpful. I wanted to also revisit one thing you skimmed by pretty quickly there, which is parking. This is a big topic, as you know, anytime we try to do infill development, because we're used to providing abundant free parking in most places for every new development. You kind of can't do that if you want to build more in the places that are already built. And so a lot of people are concerned about how finding a place to park and how that'll affect businesses and how that'll affect other folks. Could you talk about your experiences with managing parking?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a humorist, Art Buchwald, that passed away a few years ago. And when he was nearing his death, someone asked him if he was worried about death. And he said, dying is easy. Parking is hard. It's one of those things where our favorite cities, by and large, are cities that existed before the car, and they didn't have to accommodate parking. And that's one of the reasons these great walkable environments. And at the same time, they exist. We weaned ourselves off of all the alternatives, forced everybody to buy one of these things and maintain it. And now if you completely preclude it and exclude it, you've created problems because of this new paradigm that we artificially created. So you have to deal with them and you have to accept them and factor them in. The key thing is not to preclude everything else and to let them kind of ruin the place at the expense of this flow. So parking is a big factor in that. And so there are a couple of key things you could do. One is the more of your parking supply that can be shared public parking, especially in the more downtown and commercial mixed use parts of your cities, the better. Because what's great about a shared public parking kind of scenario is that it's more continuously used, and the restaurants and the movie theater use it more at night. The office building and the county government center use it more during the day, and it works better. So rather than, okay, the office building has a 200 stall parking lot that's empty all night, the theater has a 200 stall parking lot that's empty all day, they have one 200 stall lot between them, and then you have half as much land as in parking, but you're still taking care of your needs. And then that extra space could be freed up for more businesses, more housing, maybe a park or something else that would be more beneficial to life than a dang parking lot. So having as much of it public and shared as you can, get that number down. So you're still meeting your needs, but you're not overdoing it, taking all that land off of the tax rolls, and it hurts the local budget and everything. Second thing is, where does it go? These days, a lot of times you build a shopping center, parking's right front and center. So you immediately made the place not look that great. You immediately made it a terrible place to walk. If you simply flip that building in that parking lot, just that simple act, which doesn't cost a penny extra, you're just flipping things around, the environment is that much better. So now you drive and park in the back. And if you're walking down the street, you don't even have to look at it. If you got there on your bike, you don't even have to see it. And you definitely don't have to tramps through it on a hot summer day and get burned alive. So right there, you're better off. Then there are, in smaller towns, you've got to look at the price of parking. So it might not come into play in a lot of the towns in your region, but downtown in Fresno, we have 50,000 people that work there, and we're adding housing and entertainment. And so the parking gets tight. If we don't meter it, then the county health department employees literally will park on the main street and sit there all day, and people trying to grab lunch won't find a spot. So if you have those kinds of issues in maybe some of the bigger towns, looking at metering the main street, and that makes the customers for the businesses have preferential treatment, basically, and the employees and the residents, they're going to go to the lot, they're going to go to the garage, you're going to get off of the main street, then you can have a little bit more turnover and more convenience for folks that are driving in to grab a coffee or whatever else. And then the last thing, if you do all of that, you get the parking in the right spot through design standards in your zoning code or your form-based code, you get that number down to just enough and you don't overdo it, and you look at pricing if your town is busy enough to warrant it, then you can, in your zoning code, start backing off of these minimum parking requirements that a lot of our cities have. Some cities require for every residential unit a parking stall, or sometimes two, plus visitor parking. It makes it so expensive, so difficult to build sufficient housing. It's one of the factors behind our housing crisis in California. Dial that back. Let the market drive that a little bit more. Maybe one apartment developer is going to cater to folks with a lot of cars. He wants to have a lot of parking. The other one is building studio apartments right next to a big office building, and he's catering to bicycle folks and folks that are going to walk to the office building. Let him get away with just a couple of parking stalls. And if you're managing your public parking really well, it's not going to cause a problem. And you get a better city as a result.
We've had that problem in Humboldt County's zoning. They just created a new mixed-use zone, which is fantastic. Love to see that, where you can have commercial and residential together. But unfortunately, their parking minimums are so stringent that for many normal-sized lots with two employees, there will be more required parking than the lot is large. And so we have some variances, but it is still just, we have barriers to development, and it's been remarkable. You pointed out to staff and they're like, well, you know,
Yeah. And then even when staff, and I say this having been staff in that same prediction, so no judgment. When you're staff, you work so hard to get this thing on the books and you're trying to make it work. And then you realize an error like that, the idea of going back to the council, reopening everything, it's intimidating and it's not fun. And I've done it and it's worth it in the end to get it right. But man, I've got scars to show for it. One thing you have to be careful about there. Okay, we're allowing all these different uses. And over time, the market is going to change. Hey, there's more demand for office now. Oh, office is shrinking. But gosh, the restaurant scene is really exploding. And these spaces will flip from one use to another. So one problem we had in Redwood City was that we had, I think it was something like 45 different uses in our parking ordinance. And each one of them had their own parking requirement, sometimes to the tenth of a stall. And so then what would happen is the clothing shop couldn't cut it anymore, but we've got this killer Mediterranean restaurant that wants to go and everybody's really excited about it. Oh, guess what? They don't meet the parking requirement because restaurants require 10 stalls per 1,000 square feet, whereas the retail only required 5 stalls per 1,000 square feet. So then you're forced to either ignore your code, which is legally dubious. And if you're not consistently applying it, it's also weird and not very good practice. Or you don't let this cool new business go in and you keep a storefront vacant. Like, why would you do that? So what we did is we did this in Fresno too. All non-residential uses have the same parking requirement. And we came up with an average that would maybe is a little high for the office, a little low for the restaurant, but it works really well for everybody. And it's lower than the old requirements because we're trying to de-emphasize that. And then when these spaces float back and forth as they respond to market demands and people's preferences, you don't have a parking crisis. Oh yeah, come on in, new business. No problem with the parking. Whatever you have for the building is sufficient for whatever the previous use was using is good enough. And we went so far we did that in some transportation corridors in Fresno in our downtown. We just eliminated the commercial parking requirement altogether. We have a bunch of public lots and garages. And so we said, hey, for apartments, you need one stall for every two units. And for commercial, none require. We've got parking on the street. We've got the city garages. And so you don't even need to provide any.
Maybe we can just end on this kind of fear of change and how that can affect politics. Because a friend once said to me that all planning is politics. When you have something like reducing parking standards or changing from a traditional zoning to a form-based zone, these things can be scary. Change is scary. We like the places that we go to because we like them. And so the idea that we might have change here, you've said that you've had scars. What are your best techniques for bringing people along, introducing them to things that might be challenging to them, might not meet their kind of preconceived expectations, and moving the community towards better zoning?
So I think the number one key thing to getting folks open to the idea of change is don't make it feel like it's change for change, say, or change to make the greedy developer that everybody hates happy because now he has an easier time building schlocky stuff. But rather, every town has needs that aren't being addressed. Everybody, no matter how much they love their town, there's something missing that they really want. Focus on how the change helps deliver that. Oh, I'm sick of my kids moving away to another town because there's no housing for them. All right, we're going to address our housing problem. I'm sick of the city budget being completely bankrupt all the time and we can't afford to do anything nice. Well, guess what? There's oodles of data that show that denser development is way more effective at raising a good tax base and funding public services than low density development. So let's look at that. Oh my gosh, our streets are just terrible places to be. Well, guess what? With a form-based code and the extra economic activity generated by that, we can have extra resources to deal with our streets and really do. Focus on every town has something like that. And in Redwood City, when I was there, the town did not necessarily want to have, especially in the early 2000s, producing a bunch of housing for some kind of abstract housing crisis was not on the top of the general public's thought process. But they wanted their downtown to be fun again. It was fun in the 60s in living memory, and all the businesses had died or struggled. A lot of them went away. Redwood City in the 50s, 60s was the coolest downtown on the peninsula, and they were sick of Mountain View and Palo Alto and Menlo Park and Burlingame taking their glory. They wanted their downtown to be the cool one again. And so we looked at the economics of the situation, looked at land prices, and the fact of the matter is, without a bunch of housing, it was never going to happen. We were right between Hillsdale Mall and Stanford Mall, and if you think you're just going to have retail surviving when you're in the overlap of that Venn diagram between those two mega malls, forget it. But if we build in our own customer base that can keep these businesses thriving, and also then outside folks can come in from other neighborhoods and enjoy them, then we can have that bustling sidewalk environment with cool places to eat and shop that everybody wanted, and the housing gets us there. And then that was the thing that made it click for everybody. Oh my God, we need housing, because that's how we have a fun downtown again. And that started the snowball of everybody now at that point when we're doing our plan got more and more comfortable with the change. And then it was just a matter of, well, how do we make it look great? How do we put that housing in the right spot? How do we make sure we get the benefits out of it once we understood economically we need it for our downtown to thrive?
All right. Colin, do you want to have any last words?
Well, I just want to let everyone know that Dan is going to be giving a talk sponsored by CRTP Thursday, April 7th. So that should be the Thursday after this airs. And it's going to be at 6 o'clock on Zoom. And you can find the link to register for it at transportationpriorities.org. Cool. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Dan. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys. This was fun. Looking forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
All right. This has been another episode of the Eco News Report. Thank you so much to Dan Zack from Zack Urban Solutions for joining us to talk about urbanism. Join us again on this time and channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.